we all know that, the mafia profited off of prohibition, millions of dollars, and so did the Kennedys. Yeah, the Kennedys made millions bootlegging. Now, were they in bed with the mafia at that time?
Yes. So there's a lot of
Yeah.
evidence. That's part two, volume two of the
Okay,
Borgata
cool.
trilogy. But I do talk about it. There was a lot of evidence to say to suggest that. First of all, there was testimony from Meyer Lansky and Frank Costello that they dealt with Joe Kennedy, and
Yeah.
then there's a lot of evidence that points to it as well. So Joe Kennedy had these. He had the connections to the distilleries where he could get the best stuff. He also had
Okay.
something to do with medical prescriptions. He had something to do with that as well.
I
So
did not know
supposedly
that.
he made
Okay.
a lot of money in the bootlegging industry. And that's where he established these mafia contacts. So when John F. Kennedy, his son, was running for president, Joe Kennedy, using Frank Sinatra as a liaison between the mob and the Kennedy clan, was able to sort of get the Chicago mafia to swing a lot of the wards that they had control of towards Kennedy.
Welcome to the Cops and Writers Podcast. On this show, you will learn how to write the best crime-related novel or screenplay possible. Your host, Sergeant Patrick O'Donnell, worked the streets in one of the nation's largest police departments for over 25 years. Ride along with O'Donnell and his expert guests as they help you navigate the oftentimes confusing and misunderstood world of law enforcement. O'Donnell and his guests on this show do not represent any law enforcement agency. The content of this show is not meant to be legal advice. You think you need a lawyer? You probably do.
Hey, Cops and Writers. Thanks for being here with us today for another episode of the Cops and Writers Podcast. I'm Patrick O'Donnell, and I will be your host for today's show. This show is listener-supported, so thank you to all of you who keep the show going. I would especially like to thank those of you who are patrons of the show, most notably Francis Sheldrick, Kathleen Donnelly, Fran Cross, Catherine Kovacic, Richard Toles, Ryan Ta, Melinda Colt, and Carl Vondero. Your generosity helps pay for the software, equipment, and my time producing this show. Yes, you too can become a patron for less than a cup of coffee or a pint of Guinness. Just go over to patreon.com/copsandwriters. I would also like to thank all of you who have purchased my books in the Cops and Writers series, available on Amazon. Welcome back to the conclusion of my interview with former member of the Gambino crime family, now international best-selling author, television producer, and director, Louis Ferrante. Mr. Ferrante grew up in New York City and became entangled in the Gambino crime family. He was eventually arrested and served almost 10 years in prison. While he was incarcerated, he taught himself to write, and he fell in love with books. He promised himself that he would someday become an international best-selling author, and he did. Lou also created, wrote, produced, and hosted Inside the Gangster Code series for Discovery Channel about maximum security prisons and gang culture around the world. As a special treat to everyone, I'm bringing back my friend and colleague, podcaster, author, and retired NYPD detective, Vic Ferrari. Vic spent most of his life in New York City and was assigned to the NYPD's Organized Crime Unit, and specialized in stolen cars, the same area of criminal expertise that was Lou's, just on the other side of the law. Please enjoy this powerful and inspirational conversation with Lou Ferrante and Vic Ferrari. Yeah, so, I wanted to talk about prison life, but I think we could all agree that it sucks. You were sent to maximum security first, then you were cut down to a medium. How many years did that take?
Well, I got designated to a max. I probably got out of the max within like a year and a half. And so they told me year and a half, which felt like eternity though. You know, it's like every day, when you're in a place where people get murdered, it's not the same. When I went to a medium, it was like a joke. I remember the guy, when I got to the medium, I went to Otisville and I get to the medium and the guy goes to me, I went for my first little team thing there, they like reception. And the guy goes to me, listen, I know where you were. There were six or eight murders back and forth within the scope of that race war. I was there for the double homicide that day, but before and after that, murders happened, right? So he goes, look, I know where you are and I know what happens there, but I'm going to tell you right now, you're not in the same place here. So if somebody says something, you think you could take it. He says, just brush, let it roll off your shoulder. He says, it's not the same place. Like in the pen, you can't let somebody try to punk you up because you're dealing with murderers. You're dealing with people who want to rape you. You're dealing with people who want to kill you. You're dealing with, you got to react quick. So now I leave there, and this is the first time I go to lunch in the medium. A couple of guys cut me online. What the fuck are these guys doing? You know, you're in the pen. Somebody cuts you. They're trying to punk you up. You know, they're trying to. It's a thing about strength and weakness. They're trying to test you. Yeah. You better do something, right? So now I'm in the medium, and these guys cut in front of me, and I'm going, son of a bitch, what do I break the pencil, stab the guy in the neck or the eye? You know, I'm thinking into all these crazy thoughts in my head. And then all of a sudden, by the grace of God, I had that little guy I was just with in the office. And I hear his voice and he goes, who cares? And I said, he's right. I'm in a medium. Nobody's even, I'm looking around. I'm going, nobody's even looking. These guys are laughing. They're telling jokes. They might not even know they cut in front of me. I get my fried chicken. I sit down and I eat. Who cares? So I learned that it was different in the medium. Okay. Guys did things. Somebody might cut you, but they're not trying to drill a rusty dagger into your heart. They might cut you with a little raise on your chin. You know, they might cut you in the back, you know, like, or they might do something stupid because things happen in the medium too. But for the most part, no one's trying to take you out. Everybody's got hope. Nobody's doing life. Nobody's hopeless. Everybody wants to go home, and it's a different environment. Okay. You know, so like I felt like once I decompressed from the pen, I felt like just a load off my shoulders. So it was good that happened right there, that first day. Mm. And I realized that, you know, guys might say or do something stupid. They don't mean nothing by it. Nobody's testing your manhood. It's not the same place. So okay. It was a lot easier.
Yeah. So for you, what was the light bulb moment? That, you know, okay, you're in prison and it's like, man, I got to change some stuff, man. This is not the right path, but I got to make a huge change. Do you remember what you were doing and like how that happened?
Yes. So there was two things happening simultaneously. One was the light bulb moment, which I'll talk about. But the other one was, as I told you, I was starting to realize I was in a snake pit.
Yeah.
And these guys weren't, you know, when you look around, you say, I'd rather hang around with cops. At least they're cops. Tell you what they are. They, you know, this is their job. But they go home and they love their families and they're not ready to shoot their partner in the back of the head in the squad car because the captain told you to kill your partner today. I got more, you know, once you start to think that cops are better, you got to realize you're not in the right place. You know, so I'm starting to think this through going, these guys are all snakes. Any one of these guys would have killed me for money. If any one of these guys, you know, if I had $200,000-$300,000 on a load in front of me that I just got paid for, any one of these guys would have shot me in the back of the head. You know, how many guys, Sammy the Bull Gravano was killing his best friends to take over their businesses, you know, their nightclub or whatever. He's killing everybody to take over the union. So at some point I'm realizing this is all shit. These are all guys who think they're honorable, but they're doing the most dishonorable things that I could ever imagine. And I'm realizing that a lot of times when guys died, they didn't have to die. That a lot of times it was greed. If somebody dies and you say he went against the family, went against the Brigade, you understand that. Okay, he did something. He went with somebody's wife, maybe. You're not supposed to fool around with somebody's wife. And he ended up in a body bag. Okay, I get that. I understand that. But how about now when gas pipes just mislabeling somebody a rat and killing him because he wants something from him or he fears him? So this is what's bothering me. So this is all taking place at the same time that I end up going to the hole for something somebody else did. Somebody threw an apple at one of the hacks. And the prison guard was supposed to put us, this prison guard every week, you get visits and your family waits outside on the line. It was Brooklyn Detention Center, MDC, Metropolitan Detention Center in Brooklyn. And your family and your friends wait outside on this long line to get inside. And they might wait a half hour, an hour, but this guy would let them wait throughout the whole visit. They'd come in, and this guy upstairs who controlled how fast we went down to the visits to see them would let us sit upstairs for the longest time. Like he'd get a phone call and you'd see him pick up the phone. And we started to figure out that he'd get a phone call and say, yeah, Vic and Pat's family are on the visit. Send down Vic and Pat's inmate so-and-so and inmate so-and-so, you know, so they would see them. then he'd hang up the phone. He wouldn't call anybody. I said, what's this guy doing? People would walk up and say, who'd they call for the visit? Oh, that wasn't that. That was just the laundry calling. So this guy was effing with us. So one day, everybody comes back from the visits. Finally, everybody, by the time they got down there, they saw their family for 5 minutes. And one of the guys in my row, it was a dormitory, he throws an apple at the hack and it breaks apart in his off his head. So it's assault. You can't throw something. You can't throw a foreign object at a guard. So the goon squad comes up. You know, they call them the turtles, the Ninja Turtles. You know, they got all the padding on.
Yep.
You know, they come up and the guy in the row points. He says, you know, he must have said the apple came from there. He points to my row, the first row. Now everybody in my row was like 65 years old or better. The guy who threw it was an old Sicilian. You know, he was straightened out with the Sicilian mafia. He might have been straightened out here too. I knew a couple of guys who were straightened out in both places. That's an interesting conversation too. But he points to my row and they figure the kid did it. I'm in my, you know, 26, 27. So they grab me and they drag me to the hole and they rough me up all the way to the hole thinking I assaulted a cop. I said, I didn't do it. So at this point, they kept coming to my cell going, did you do it? So I'm saying he must not have been able to say I specifically did it,
right. But
they must be sure it's me. So they're coming every day and they go, did you hit the guard? Did you? And I'm going, look, I didn't do it. Well, then who did it? I don't know, Sherlock. Go find out who did it. What's it have to do with me? So in the end, I was talking to one of the guys, lieutenant of guards that day, and the food slot was low. And we were talking through the food slot because he denied me my food, my tray. And he says, you don't want to tell me who did it. You're not going to get food. So I reached through the thing and I went to grab his tie and I gave it a yank. And I was a hot-headed kid at the time, something that I'd never do today. I grabbed his tie and I gave it a yank and I pulled it off his neck. I said, it's a clip on you, son of a bitch. I threw it back at him. Yeah. So he looks, then he stands up and he was a tall guy. He stood up through the reinforced glass and he said, he goes, you think we'd wear real ties with you animals in here? Of course it's a clip on. So in other words, you know, let you morons strangle us. So he says, you're an animal. He says, look at you. He says, you're in a cage. He goes, you're nothing but an animal. And he walks away. And I says, I am an animal. That was the one click, that moment. So everything was building up until then. But that was the moment where a guy called me an animal. I realized I was in a little cage. And even though I wasn't responsible for throwing the apple at the guard, I did a million other things that either I went to the hole for by then or I ducked going to the hole for. So I knew I was a bad apple. And he called, you know, and it, no pun intended, I was a bad apple and I'm in there over a rotten apple. Right. And it ends up that he calls me an animal at a time when I was weighing that we were all beasts and savages to be involved in this shit life. That's what I was thinking. And he calls me an animal and he hits me with that at the moment I realize I am an animal. And I said, my mother didn't raise me this way. My mother raised me to be good to people. My mother raised me that there is a God, to pray to God. When I was a little kid, I used to kneel beside the bed and pray with my mother. And my mother died in my arms when I was young. She died of cancer. She was beautiful. Mm-hmm. And I didn't believe there was a God after that. But I started to think through things. And I said, whether there's a God or not, my mother didn't raise me this way. And I'm dishonoring her memory. And then I started to think about all the people I had traumatized, all the things I had done. And by the time I got out of that hole, I was a different person. That was the big moment.
Okay. Yeah. Was that in the Max?
No, that was in Brooklyn Detention Center.
Okay.
Yeah, that was before I went to the back.
She's waiting on trial or sentencing.
Okay.
Yeah.
Got it.
I started to change already. I asked for books then. I talked to my friend. I said, send me in books. I started to read and I found what I loved. I would have never read a book before. I never read a book cover to cover in my life. I was literate. I went to high school. You know, I didn't go to college or university, but I knew how to read, you know, but I never read a book cover to cover in my life. And that's possible when you don't come from a family that comes from like a college educated family. Even if you went to school, the first book my father in his 70s ever read was mine. My father goes, I never read a book cover to cover either. You know, so, you know, you come from a working family, you get through school, you know, you
change
a couple of thoughts, you know, and that's, we all know how that happens. Right.
Absolutely.
So, you know, and then when I started reading, I fell in love with books and then I realized I found something I loved. And that's when I taught myself how to write.
Let's go back here. You know, so you have this moment and it's like, okay, you educated yourself. You know, it's like, I remember listening to you on a different, maybe it was Art of Manliness. You know, you're reading books and you're taking notes. You're not just reading, you're analyzing. You know,
that's
right. You're learning the craft yourself. You're taking the time and, you know, you're doing all this stuff. And it's like, okay, you're turning your back on what you were before. Now, I thought there was no getting out of the mafia. I mean, how does that work?
Nowadays, anybody could leave as long as you leave. You know, first of all, there's so many rats that they would have a hard time tracking them all down. So you could, if you leave with honor, like I did, you know, I said, look, I'm not ratting on nobody. If I got to leave here in a pine box, that's what happens. I chose this. I made these decisions. I'm responsible for my own self. You know, I never cried and goes, but I didn't know this. And I like the rats do. I get fed up with the shit excuses I hear. Gotta be honest with you. You know, like, you know, well, you didn't send my wife commissary, or, you know, why do I got to do all the time? I only did a little of the crime. Come on, man. You know what you're involved in. You're a man. Man up. So I feel like, you know, if I'm going to them, while I did this in jail, I'm going to you guys and saying, look, if I ever get out of here, if I never leave, so be it. But if I ever get out of here, I just want to be left alone. Everybody told me, good, you know, go your own way. Do what you got to do. We miss you. But what are you going to tell me if I'm not snitching? You're going to tell me no? You know, like with all the snitches that are out there. Like one time somebody said, are you worried about your life? I says, you know what? I'll tell this to every mobster out there. After you're done killing the 1,000 rats that are walking around the streets right now, not only that, I'll kill myself. You don't even have to look for me. After you're done killing the 1,000, I'll kill myself, because you know what? I won't even make you look for me, but they're never going to do it. They're never going to do it. So, you know, yeah.
You know, I was just going to say that, you know, dealing with all the little gangsters, you know, that I dealt with on the job, you know, you're talking about like gangster disciples, you know, vice lords, Latin kings, queens, whatever. The old timers were a lot less likely to be a rat. They just took their lumps. Mm-hmm. But the younger kids, shit. Mm-hmm. You'd offer them, like, hey, you might get, like, I'll talk to the DA and see if they'll give you, okay, I'll give you everything. It was like,
right.
And some were a lot more organized than others. My first night, that was my second or third night as a sergeant, I'm finishing up with roll call and there's a homicide. You know, it's like 12:05. I'm working midnight to 8, and I'm like, come on. Right off the bat, you know, it's like, I don't even have my paperwork done. I don't even know what I'm doing yet. You know, I'm a brand new guy. So, but I've been to a zillion homicides before, no big deal. Now, this is on the south side of town with the Hispanic gangs. And my cop's doing a crackerjack job. There's yellow tape everywhere. Everybody's separated, you know, blah, blah, blah. And two of my cops come up to me and they're like, hey, do you want us to go get the guy that just killed this dude? I'm like, what are you talking about? I said, yeah, we know who he is. We know where he lives. We're just going to go scoop him up for you. And I'm like, I don't understand. Because on the north side of town, it was a lot of like random violence. And there was gang stuff. You know, it's like you're slinging dope in the wrong neighborhood. You know, you sell, you know, drywall instead of crack, or ivory soap instead of crack. That'll buy you a bullet in your head. But and I'm like, so you got to educate me, guys. It's like, well, this guy was a Latin king. He ratted on a guy and he wound up going to prison for like 15 years or something, like some crazy amount of time. And he promised at sentencing, he said, when I get out, I'm going to kill you. So sure as shit, he got out. He was only out for like 2 or 3 days. He knocked on the door and the wife didn't recognize him. He said, hey, honey, it's for you. Guy came in, just empties his gun, goes back home, sitting on the couch, just waiting for the cops.
Wow.
You know,
it's a great story.
Yeah. I mean, then we had another one exactly like that. It was another Hispanic gang where this guy is in a bar. He just got out of prison. So he's enjoying a nice cold beer. He's all happy and stuff. Well, in come just by this other person's bad luck, a rat that was in the gang. And he ratted him out, and he was just in prison for a long haul. And he was armed. He empties the gun, kills the dude, and then he looks at the bartender who was cutting up fruit, you know, like limes and lemons. He said, give me that knife. He says, you realize I'm calling the cops. He said, yeah, I know. I have no problem going back to prison. This guy put me in prison. Yeah. So he just starts hacking away.
Yeah.
he knew. He's like, yeah, no big deal.
Yeah.
We'll be right back.
Today's episode is sponsored by the thrilling audiobook Avenging Adam, Book 1 in the FBI Canine Thriller series, written by author Jodi Burnett. Sparks fly between hotshot FBI agent Rick Sanchez and no-nonsense FBI canine handler Kendra Dean as they chase a ruthless serial killer. Witness an electrifying blend of suspense, romance, and redemption, where internal conflicts challenge our heroes as much as their target does. Will they catch the killer before it's too late? Grab Avenging Adam now. It's more than a story. It's an experience. Get 50% off the Avenging Adam audiobook at jody-burnett.com/copsandwriters.
I got to tell you, it's a little refreshing for me to hear. I have to admit.
God. But those were the old timers, like I said, you know, yeah. And it depended on which gang it was, you know, just
right.
But enough of that. So, you know, we alluded to, you know, like a higher being and faith and all that. When you were at your lowest in prison, you know, did you find God or did you turn against God? I mean, it sounds like you turned towards him.
I did. I realized that once I, through knowledge, I think, through reading, all the books I was reading, I was starting to learn that there's a big world out there. And then, you know, I'm learning science. I'm learning physics. I'm learning history, biographies I'm reading. And I'm seeing that as my mind's putting together all the pieces. You know, before that, all I knew was Queens, right? Queens and trucks. Queens and trucks. Queens and trucks. You know, that, so it's very limited, my mind. And now, all of a sudden, it's opened up to all of these different things. There's a whole world out there. And even in the scientific world, the sun rises and sets, the clouds bring rain and they water the plants grow and we eat them and it nourishes the body and it's perfect for the body. So there must be a higher power behind this. And then the other thing too is I feel like I'm being punished for something. I feel like I deserve what I'm getting. So unlike a lot of people go, I don't deserve this, and they rat, I feel like I did deserve this. You can't go around stick guns at people and not think that you deserve this. I deserve this. I'm getting what I deserve. And I thought the FBI guys were the bad guys. I thought the cops were the bad guys. I'm starting to realize they're not the bad guys. They got a guy like me off the street. I don't belong on the street. So maybe they're not the bad. I'm starting to rethink things. You know, I'm starting to rethink things. And I'm starting to see that the world, maybe there is a higher power. Maybe I deserve to be punished and therefore I am being punished. Maybe one time there was a guy I remember that bothered me, somebody I heard. And I heard that the father went to visit him in the hospital. And when I heard the father visited him in the hospital, I remember it bothered me that the father would have to see the son in the hospital. And then I remember going down on a visit one day and seeing my father's face. And I stopped in my tracks and I saw in my mind that kid's father. What, you know, my father was suffering like that kid's father had suffered. My father's got to see me now in prison. That kid's father had to see him in a hospital. So I'm starting to make these connections and I'm saying, I deserve this. So if there is a higher power, maybe it's not such a bad power. And I know what, once again, too, if there was a God, I hated this higher being after watching my mother disintegrate. This was a horrible thing. If there was a God, I felt like God wouldn't have allowed that to happen.
Right.
But now there's some time and space between that. And I'm able to think that my mother did teach me right. My mother did leave a proper legacy behind. It's up to me now to pick that up and use what she taught me. So maybe there is a God though still. Maybe, you know, my mother would always teach me right till the day she died that there is a God. If I'm not here one day, I always realize that. So I start to then realize that there is a higher power, and I start to now gravitate towards understanding that there is. And as I start to change my life for the better, as I'm reading, as I'm teaching myself how to write, as I'm promising that I'm never going to go back to this crap life again. And I'm showing it because there's a lot of things you could do in there that still sort of like leaves you part of that. And I'm moving away from it. And there's guys on the street that I'm letting them know, don't wait for me. If you think I'm going back, I'm not. So I'm making real changes and I'm starting to help. I'm helping people in prison. If a guy was railroaded, I'd look over his case once I taught myself. Well, I went through seven attorneys total, hired and fired seven attorneys, went for tons of money, and eventually went to law library and taught myself with a friend of mine's help. A friend of mine who was a legal eagle taught me how to study law, how to file briefs. And then once I reversed my own case on a technicality, if I saw other people were railroaded, I was helping them. Obviously, there's a lot of people who belong in jail who you really don't want out. You know, I'm not like one of these people who go, empty the jails. You out of your mind? You don't want those people out here.
No, you don't.
Yeah. No, hell no. And when I was bad, you didn't want me out here, you know, but there are people who deserve to have gotten less than they got.
Sure.
There are people who, yeah. So those I did try to help. And the more I tried to better myself, the more I saw that things were getting better for me. And eventually that's how the appeal happened. You know, eventually I reversed my case and I thought that that was the work of a higher power.
So what was the technicality that you found?
Well, what happened was after I took a plea and I pled guilty and they dismissed the rest of the indictment. If you plead guilty, that's part of the plea agreement, right?
Yeah.
And I took an honorable plea. I refused to even mention my co-defendants' names in my plea. I said, Your Honor, I won't mention their names. I refuse to take a dishonorable plea. He understood. And he said, you and your Confederates, he said. I remember when he said that, I'm like, Confederates? What's this have to do with the Civil War? Like by then I'm reading. I didn't even know that word could be used for like friends and associates.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, I'm starting to learn for the first time. So anyway, I take the plea and the judge was in such a rush to get me in and out of the courtroom that he was supposed to ask me certain questions he did not ask me during the plea allocution. And what happened was though, I didn't know this. My lawyer, who was that last lawyer I used was a bastard. I didn't like him. And he was in a rush to get in and out of the courtroom too. And he filed a brief saying I had no appellate issues, no appealable issues. And he waived my right to appeal as soon as the sentencing was over.
Really?
And the appellate case was interesting. Yeah, real bastard.
That doesn't sound right.
Real bastard. I realize now, I look back, I'll give you a little insight into something that happened here. It's a different story on its own. But the last lawyer was hired by a friend of mine who I thought was doing me a favor. And that friend had a lot to hide and wanted me in and out as fast as possible so he would not be revealed as a rat, which is interesting.
Yeah,
so that's a whole different story on its own.
Okay.
So yeah, so this guy gets me in and out of the courtroom, this last lawyer. This is before I studied law. And then it was either he filed an Anders brief or I got an Anders brief. Whatever the case was, the appellate court sends me something to say, sends me, CCs me in prison. So I get a copy. The appellate court instructs him to look over the plea allocution and find what's wrong with it.
They found something.
Oh,
the appellate court. I said, wow, if you don't attribute this to a higher power, and once again, never snitched, never dry snitched, never open snitched, nothing. This is by the grace of God that the appellate court sees something and then tells him, no, there are appellate issues, and CCs me. So when he CCs me, I get a copy of this and I'm bunking. Here's how God works. I end up I'm bunking with this guy. I come out of the penitentiary where there's strong racial lines. Whites and blacks are at each other's throats, right? The Aryan Brotherhood acted death to black Muslims as soon as I got there. There's a race war going on. Shouldn't have anything to do with Italians because we're not considered white or black, but we are considered close enough. Aryans still hate us. And the blacks, if you're close enough, if we can't find a white, you know, you're white to us. So we're really close enough. So you're sort of in the middle of that. And I leave there and I go to the medium, which was a lot better. But I do this kid a favor. And he's leaving jail and he's got no clothes when he's going home. He said he'd been away like 10 years, didn't have any clothes to go home to. I go, look, I'm going to tell my mother, you're a little, tiny little bit taller than me, but everything else were identical. I'm going to tell my sister to pack up all my belongings in my old room, my old closet, and give me an address. I'll send them to you. He goes, what about you? I says, yeah, I'm doing 13 years. By the time I get home, they'll be out of style anyway. Maybe you'll be able to use them before they're out of style. So I call my sister. I said, do me a favor. Here's this kid's address. Go pack up everything in my closet and mail it to his address. So he comes to me before he leaves. He goes, look, he was my bunkie. He goes, look, I gotta pay you back. I go, if you pay me back, I'm going to lose the good deed. I don't want you to pay me back. I'm trying to make up for the shit I did. So he goes, no, please, let me pay you back. I go, I don't want anything in return. Please, just let me do you the favor. Believe me, somehow you'll help me with karma. I'm working off bad karma. So he goes, no, at least let me give you a bunkie. I'll get you another bunkie. That's good. We got along. I'll get you a good guy. So he brings this kid to me and he brings me, I go, fine. So he brings this kid to me and the kid's black. So I says, look, I got no problem with black people. I dated black girls. I had black friends. I had no problem with that, but I just left the penitentiary. You're not supposed to sell blacks and whites together. So he goes, that's the pen. This is a medium. We don't have that problem here. So he goes, you're allowed. So I go, all right, fine. brings him in my cell. We hit it off. He became one of my dearest friends, nicest guy in the world. I took care of him years after I went home. I sent him commissary on the sly. You're not supposed to mail. One convict isn't supposed to mail another commissary. I'd send his mother money, you know, so yeah. So, you know, I tell his mother to go to dinner, tell his mother to send him money. I figured out how to get around it without breaking laws, right? So whatever the case was, he gives me this kid. Now I get this thing from the appellate division and he looks at it and he goes, I'm a legal. I work in the law library all day. I could help you out.
Oh, wow.
He goes, fire the lawyer. We're going to file pro se and we'll find what's wrong with this. He ends up finding this kid was a genius and he taught me law. And through him, I ended up learning law and filed the pro se briefs with him and ended up going on to understand enough to help other people. Mm. So I ended up filing pro se briefs with the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, fired the lawyer, and the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, when we get the judges, the three panel judges, there's three judges on a panel. We get the panel. He goes, you got a good shot. He reads case law all day. He goes, you got a good shot with this guy. He goes, this guy, his name was Guido Calabrese. I go, no, Italians don't like giving Italians breaks. I'm dead. So I go, look at Giuliani. I said, look at Giuliani. He looks up every Italian he sees. I said, I'm dead. He goes, no. He goes, I'm telling you. He goes, this guy Calabrese, you got a shot with him. So it ends up that Guido Calabrese writes the decision and they reverse the case on a technicality due to the plea allocution. So I go back to court. And that's when I learned that the guy had violated the witness protection program. And I remember the prosecutor, you know, and this is all, if you don't think there's a higher power, this is all happening on the heels of me changing my life. Suddenly the God, the same God I felt that put me in jail and wouldn't let seven attorneys that I spent tons of money on, William Kunstler, Barry Slotnick, and everybody else that followed, couldn't get me out of this mess. And now I'm getting myself out. Yeah. The doors are swinging open. I mean, there's a God, you know, and what happened in between? In the interim, all that happened different was I changed my life. Mm. So, you know, believe me, there was a saying. I remember these guys that used to go to these services told me, if you have 1 million people against you and God is on your side, you could overcome that whole army. But if you have 1 million people with you and God's against you, your army ain't worth the crap. And that's the bottom line. So I felt like once I came to the conclusion that there was a higher power and somebody was pulling the strings, and that's how I got. Eventually, I went to the state, though. My odyssey was not over. I had that stick up. Remember the stick up that my co-defendant did in the state? Well, that should have ran concurrent, but because I reversed my federal case before time, I still had time. So I went to the state. As soon as I got there, they hit me at the parole board, and they hit me with 2 years when I got there. And so I told my lawyer, I go, they really want to hold me for this? I said, they're supposed to run concurrent. So he goes, let me call the prosecutor. So he calls the prosecutor and when I call back the lawyer, he tells me, look, the prosecutor said, if you want to talk, he could still get you out. I go, let me tell you, if I didn't talk when all this time was
exactly
in front of me,
come
right,
on.
Why the F would I talk when it's behind me? This ain't happening. So he said, well, then he told you enjoy the 2 years. So now when I go back to the parole board. So the first time I went to the parole board, I go in front of them and I go, listen, I studied this. I studied that. I taught classes. I taught history. I taught literacy. I taught people who were illiterate how to read. I did all these things while I've been in here. And they said, hit them for 2 years, which was the max they could hit me for. So I said, wow, these sons of bitches. I said, all the things I said I did, they didn't care. So when I'm going back to the board, there's only like, if they bang me again, they can only get me. They can only max me out at like 6 months more. So when I go back to the board 2 years later, I go in front of them with a completely different attitude. They go, what have you done with yourself? I go, nothing. I didn't want to care. I go, let them hit me for the 6 months. I'm not going to grovel in front of these people. I did it last time and they didn't want to give me a break. So everything they did, I was nasty. I didn't give a F. And they go, paroled. I go, oh man, this is crazy. No rhyme or reason to this crap. This is ridiculous. So whatever it is, they must have quotas. I don't know what they do, but you know, so I got out. So that was sort of like, you know, in the end, I did 8.5 years.
Okay. When did you get out?
I got out in 2003, January 2003. Right. So yeah, 8.5 years. I went in June 94.
So you get out of prison. What was the first thing you did? Was there like a favorite meal or something that you couldn't wait to get?
I was usually craved the things you grow up on. So, you know, Irish people would crave, you know, Irish soda bread or corned beef and cabbage, whatever mom made, right? Something with potatoes.
Mom was a horrible cook. I mean, I love my mom. Don't get me wrong. But Irish people can't cook for shit. They really can't.
Yeah, I mean, I grew up with Irish. I got some good meals in their houses. So, you know.
Something boiled and bland.
Yeah, I craved Italian. I craved a slice of pizza. I craved a dish of macaroni. You know, and a hamburger. We all grew up on hamburgers. Yep. I craved a hamburger. So those are the things I wanted first. And then I got that. And once I get out of my system, you know, then you eventually you're back to normal. But I went through all the foods I craved for a long time.
Gotcha. Yeah. Hey, let's talk writing. Your newest book, Borgata, Rise of Empire, A History of American Mafia, is part of the Borgata trilogy. First off, I got to say, I loved it. It's an awesome book. I totally, totally think that people should read it. But what really jumped out at me is your writing. It's incredibly authentic. You know, some phraseology that you used. I mean, I was just sitting, I was at the gym. I was listening to it at the gym or I was in my car. I used like the Alexa app. Even like you can download it on your Kindle. And then Alexa will read it to you. I mean, it's monotone, you know, whatever, but I do a lot better with audiobooks. I'm dyslexic. I'm a really slow reader. So I have to have somebody read it to me. So things like, seems like he was cut up like a hero sandwich. The mob doesn't, the mob doesn't forget, but doesn't forgive. The mob doesn't use whiteout to erase mistakes. They use rub out. I laugh my ass off when I'm just like, oh my God, this is so cool. You know,
that's great.
You are so dialed into that culture, obviously. And I don't think anybody else could do this justice. You know, you weren't over the top and you weren't like not enough. You're right in that sweet spot where, you know, it's like I'm learning a ton that I didn't know about. You know, it's a lot of really good history, but it's also very entertaining. I mean, how did you try to do that or is it just come naturally?
Thank you. Well, first, thank you. Thank you so much for all those compliments. And I'm so glad you enjoyed it. Thank you.
I loved it.
Yeah. I appreciate that. Thank you. I think that I taught myself how to write in a prison cell and I taught myself how to write through other great authors. Like at one point or another, I said, I don't have writing. There's no writing classes. I never went to college or university. How am I going to learn how to write? And I realized that everything that Leo Tolstoy knows about writing, to use him as an example, is in the pages of Anna Karenina, in the pages of War and Peace. You need only read them and with a really analytical eye. And that's what I did. I would see how he introduces a character, how he begins and ends a plot, how he exits a character, how he develops a plot, how the plot moves along. And how he sort of like maybe builds suspense and et cetera. So I would, War and Peace and Anna Karenina weren't the most suspenseful novels you could read. But as I went on to read so many others, and I was always had an eye to how they were doing it. So I taught myself how to write. And I think that I thought that a big part of the writing craft is if you could write as close as you can to the way you could talk, is great. And obviously, though, I write a lot better than I talk. I'm like the stutterer, you know, who sings beautifully, you know, like, you know, I mean, I, you know, yeah, I write better.
Okay.
But, you know, I could go over it, though. I could edit it. I could tweak it. You know, I have those opportunities, but I always wanted my voice to be in there. And I hope that it always strikes you as you and I are having a conversation at a pub.
That's what it felt like. Yes, absolutely.
That's great. Yeah, so that's great.
I think, and I just ordered one of your books. I think interesting people write interesting things because it comes out. It just, even, I mean, I'm sure there's people that were involved in your world that couldn't write a book because they're just not really that interesting, but you're an interesting guy. You know how to tell a story. If you know how to tell a story, you can obviously write.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank
I totally you. Agree yeah. with you. So why write this specific book? Why do this trilogy?
It happened by accident. I was invited by the German media group, Axel Springer. They control a lot of the media in not only Germany, but Eastern Europe, as I understand it. Mm. They had invited me to a retreat for their editors being held in Agrigento, Sicily. And I went there, and because everyone spoke German as a first language and English as a second language, they seated me for dinner next to this gentleman named George, who spoke fluent English. And him and I hit it off. He was in his 90s. And when I was in the mob, even, I always gravitated towards older guys. I like to hear, you know, I was like, that's why I was stuck in that row with the older guys when I got caught for the apple, okay. You know, that I didn't throw. Yeah, I liked hanging out with the older guys. They had more wisdom. They had more experiences. I always wanted to hang around with the older guys. So here I am at a table with a guy who was in his 90s, early 90s at the time, maybe 92 or 3. And we hit it off. We talked about history, the Middle Ages, the Reformation, the Renaissance, feudal society, et cetera, up and through the 20th century. When he tells me he fled the Holocaust with 16 shillings in his pocket, he left Austria and landed in England. Yeah, and then he tells me he wants to publish my next book. Well, it turns out this gentleman by the name of George was Lord George Weidenfeld, one of the biggest publishers of the 20th century. He published Pope John Paul II's memoirs. He published Charles de Gaulle's memoirs. He published Lyndon Johnson's memoirs. He published The Double Helix by Crick and Watson, on and on and on. All of the great historians, Arnold Toynbee. So I was blown away. And I'm like, wow, son of a bitch. I came here to hang out with a bunch of Germans and drink in Sicily. And here I am now, you know, moving with a book deal. So, you know, the next day we met and we're overlooking the ruins in Agrigento. And he specifically, him and his lovely wife, Lady Annabelle, suggested that I write a history of the mafia. And they felt that because of my experiences and maybe because, like Vic was just saying, maybe storytelling, et cetera, you know, I would be the guy to be able to not only tell the stories, but to input my own insights. And I was able to do that. And so that's sort of how it began. Now, I thought my last books took me a year to write. So I figured I'll be in and out of this in a year. A year went by. I was still knocking off, you know, look at the size of my library. I'm still knocking off stacks of books.
Sure.
And I'm not even starting to write yet. So I'm like, wow, son of a bitch, this is going to take a long time. And it morphed into I was glued to my desk for the better part of 7 years. I'm going on 8 years now. I'm tweaking volume 2. So, this, you know, by the time I get out volume 3, it'll be 9 or 10 years. So the whole thing's has taken a long time. Volume 2 will be out.
There's a whole lot of history going on and a whole lot of, you know, research that has to go into that. That's a lot of legwork. Yeah. Now, is your family from Sicily specifically?
So I'm a sort of a mutt of an Italian. My mother's mother. So I come out of a Sicilian womb. My mother's mother is Sicilian. So, you know, I'm sort of considered coming out of a Sicilian womb. My mother's father was Nobili Don from Naples, Neapolitan. And my father's both parents are direct first generation immigrants. They came from Bari. So I'm Baresi, Nobili Don, and Sicilian. So I'm a mix of those three. Yeah. But they would consider, you know, I would consider the strongest trait in me having come from a Sicilian womb. And my mother is raised Sicilian by a Sicilian mother, more so Sicilian than anything, but it's a mix of different Italians, Barese, Nobili Don, and Sicilian.
Yeah. Gotcha. So reading this book, it might be helpful to do a little vocabulary, you know, so let's go through it real quick. Skipper.
A skipper is a capo. We would say a skipper, or you go see a rabbi. We would say that's basically a captain or a capo is a skipper.
So what level in the mob is that?
He's high. There's capo regimes. Capo regimes, each capo is in charge of a regime, a group of soldiers and associates. So your captain is basically who's the guy you answer to, and he goes right to the boss. So that's sort of like it's middle management, I guess, or like an officer corps, the captains. You know, he's sort of like, you know, it's basically,
So a captain, skipper, and capo are around the same? Is that...
They're all accessible, revolving terms for the same thing.
All right. Yeah. Gotcha. Borgata.
Borgata is originally a borgata is like an Italian neighborhood. Like they would say a barrio in Spanish.
Yeah.
Like a poor Italian neighborhood would be a borgata. And then they use the term borgata or the brugada, they would say in sort of like with the Italian accent on it for like a crew. So like if you were with, let's say the Gambino family, you're with John's borgata, John's brugada. John would be the boss. That would be his crew. If you were Vic Amuso with the Lucchese family, you were Vic's Borgata or Vic's Brugada. That's his crew. And so on. The Colombo family, Carmine Persico or Vicarino, he was in for a little while. So that's sort of where it comes. But it comes from a poor Italian neighborhood is the real sort of like a close-knit poor Italian neighborhood. Okay. It becomes a becomes the name of a family. So that's how I use Borgata, is because an Italian mafia family is a Borgata.
Okay. The Don, he's the king, the head of whatever.
Yeah, the original word Don comes from the Spanish Don. When the Spanish were in Sicily, Sicily had invaders of every type.
Sure.
The French, the Arabs, the Spanish, the Romans, the Greeks, throughout history, there have been many invaders who controlled Sicily for a while. When the Spanish were in control of Sicily, they left the word Don behind. Don so-and-so was the lord of the manor. Don this, Don that. So when the mafia Don started to emerge, they used Don. And then when they came to America, the old grease balls, they would say, originally used the word Don. And then that sort of morphed into the corporate culture in America, turned that into the boss, right? We use boss in America now,
sure.
The boss. So, you know, once in a while, the newspapers might use Don. I still use it in the book because it's an easy way to, you know, refer to the mafia boss. But basically, they say the boss.
Okay, gotcha. Yeah. Now, made man.
A made man is a guy who took the initiation. He went in front of, you know, a bunch of other guys. He burnt a saint. He took the oath. He said, this family comes before my own family. If they call me in the middle of the night, and so on and so on.
Sure.
That's what I was aspiring to be before I went to prison. That's what I would have gotten when I came home had I not changed, because I was a prime candidate. I did all my time. I kept my mouth shut. I had already paid my dues. I did everything. Everything I ever did was on record. I was an easy one. And a friend asked me when I came home, you want me to put you up? And I said, no, I'm done. So that's sort of what you do. You take the initiation, you burn the saint, you prick your finger, whatever it is, you're done.
All right. You know, so get your button. Is that the same thing?
Yeah, you get your button. They call them button guys. Yeah.
No, you push a button. Literally get like a button?
No, nobody gives you a button.
No button? No. Okay.
No, they give you the butt of their shoe in the back of your ass.
Yeah. How about omerta?
Omerta, this is interesting. So when I grew up, I always understood omerta to be like the code of silence, right? Omerta, you keep your mouth shut. You live by omerta. When I did my research, and I break it down in the book, omerta means a lot more than that. Omerta was everything it was in the beginning in the Sicilian culture. It encapsulated everything it means to be a man. So, for example, you guys worked with the NYPD. You went home, you gave your paycheck to your wife or your family, you supported your wife and your family and your mortgages and your kids, and you did everything like that. You're dutiful. You're living up to what it is to be a man. Now, there are other things. That's one aspect of it. You're being a man. You're supporting your family. You're taking care of your family. But then the other aspect was, if you don't call the cops, you take care of things on your own. So if somebody's got a beef with you, and somebody, your neighbor says, your neighbor's been, you know, screwing around with your wife, let's say, and you want to kill him. And you guys get into a beef, you get into a little fist fight or whatever. Maybe he hands you your ass. And now you're not supposed to call the police on him. You're supposed to now go and shoot him. Or maybe, you know, you're supposed to take care of this yourself. You know, somebody's making a fool of you. You don't call the police. This is your problem. You don't go to the police. You handle it on your own. So that was also part of omerta. So it's being dutiful. It's taking care of things on your own. You man up. And when you don't rat, it's not just a code of silence, but you're manning up. I'm responsible for the things I did. I hijacked the trucks. I hijacked. Nobody twisted my arm. Now I got to go to jail for it. It's time to pay the piper. You know, you want to dance, you got to pay the band, right? But the rats like to say, because they don't follow omerta, well, I got a reason why. I'm doing it because, man up. You knew what you were doing. You got to go to jail. So that's part of omerta too.
Okay.
And so on and so forth. But it's all in my book. You could break it. I break it down in the very beginning. You have the understanding. Then I get into the blood and guts, the intrigues and stuff. But first I give you the short tutorial.
Okay. Guma.
A gumara. Your gumara was like your girl on the side. It's like your girlfriend. You know, most guys I knew, they would try to have like a virtuous wife at home who gives birth to their children, and you hope for sons. And then they had a gumara on the side. They kept her in an apartment, and they had somebody they could go around and fool around with and do all the things you would want a woman to do that you wouldn't want to ask your wife to do. And that's the gumara.
Okay. Yeah. So
plain and simple. And by the way, if somebody doesn't like it out there, don't blame me. I'm just giving you the definition.
I know. He's going to catch you in that.
Don't shoot the messenger. Yeah, that's right.
Don't shoot the messenger. I'm just giving you the definition.
So the mob formed in Sicily. Sicily was an island to itself. It didn't like rules or outsiders. Is there still a big influence of mafia in Sicily today, do you think?
As when I was, the years I was active, I knew Sicilian mafiosos.
Okay.
And they were old school. I liked them. I got along with them. They were tough. They lived by Omerta. I knew a couple of wise guys who were straightened out in Sicily and straightened out here in the United States with a different family. So I asked the obvious question is, who are you loyal to? And they said, I'm a loyal to them when I'm there. I'm a loyal to here when I'm here. I go, what if you got a beef between the two? And they said, you know, they didn't want to say, what do you want for dinner, Louis? You know, they got off the subject, you know? So they didn't want to go down that route.
Right.
So,
okay.
But the Sicilians, as when I was on the street, they were still active. And right. As I understand it, they still have a presence now in Palermo. It's in their blood. It's what they do. They're not as strong as they once were because the public doesn't put up with it in Sicily as they once did. You know, there was a time when after the Sicilians blew up a couple of different judges and prosecutors, the public it nauseated the public, and the public revolted and said, that's it. We're done.
Okay.
We don't want this shit around anymore. And without public support, it's very hard to continue like they once did. Just like here in the United States, it's difficult to continue without public support and without public corruption. Once the mob lost it, you know, it's hard to bribe a judge when the judge makes $250,000 a year with benefits and goes to all these beautiful galas and sales on the weekends in the Long Island Sound. What are you going to offer this guy that he doesn't have?
Yeah, you can't.
So it's tough to buy a judge. Yeah, you can't. And even cops. You know, I had my brother-in-law was a cop. He did his 20 years. You guys are cops. Yeah, you get. Yeah, my brother-in-law. When my sister met my brother-in-law, she brought him up on a visit. At first, before I changed, I said, "Is a cop? A cop? You bring me a cop? What are you doing?" And then it ended up being the nicest guy in the world. He'd bring my niece and nephews when they were born, or my two nephews rather, to come see me. He was a good man. You know, he did his 20 years. He got out. He never let me down. Anything I ever asked for him, he was there for me. He was a good man. I was there for him. And when I changed my life, I understood it. But anyway, you know, where are we going with this? I got on my brother-in-law.
No, that's okay. It's just talking about mafia in Sicily today. But another thing I want to talk about, you know.
Oh, no, bribing a cop. How are you going to bribe a cop? Yeah. That's what I wanted to say. How are you going to bribe a cop when a cop makes, you know, $60,000, $70,000 a year? He's got a great pension to look forward to.
Even for $100. I mean, come on. Yeah,
500 or 1,000. Well, you need that all in your head.
But Lou, right? But Lou knows, like, the problem is, right? A lot of these, there's a fine line between cops sometimes and guys that go the other way. And what I wanted to ask you was it more about the money with you, or was it more about the excitement? Because I was watching you on another podcast and you brought something up that resonated with me. You said, you know, I'm glad it's over, but I know I'm never going to be able to experience that rush and excitement. And cops go through that too.
Absolutely.
And I had a great 20-year career of chasing car thieves.
Yeah.
The closest thing I get to that now is playing softball once I'm coming out of the batter's box, because I can't chase anybody anywhere anymore. So the excitement is gone. But like I was saying, there's a fine line with cops growing up in the same neighborhood you grew up in. And the little problem, it's sometimes not even a bribe. It's the accessibility to guys. You got the same kid going into the same candy store for 100 years, and Uncle Lou is a capo. And one day Uncle Lou says to the kid, who's now a cop, my daughter got into a car accident and the fucking son of a bitch took off, but she's got his license plate. I hate to ask.
Yeah.
Can you run this plate for me? The cop doesn't know, or he knows, but he's going to do it anyway because he knows Uncle Lou or Uncle Vito. And then that guy owes that guy money, and he sends a couple of guys over to tune him up with a baseball bat. That's it's not even really a bribe. It's the accessibility because you grew up in those neighborhoods.
Yeah. And it's also too, that goes to bonding. So that bonding that you just spoke about, when you grow up with different people, that's usually where corrupt relationships stem from. Yeah, you know, you grew up with a guy all your life. He goes one way, you go another way, but you guys know each other your whole lives, or your families know each other. And neighborhoods were very different when we were younger.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's like, I feel like, you know, back then I could hide in any neighbor's house if the cops or the feds were after me, you know, and the neighbor would hide me. You know, like, you know, now I can't imagine knocking on a neighbor's door and going, I got to hide. The cops or the FBI, they go, what? I'm calling the police right now. You know, so like it's a different world. So, but yeah, I totally get what you just said. And I know a million examples. I don't want to out nobody.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. A million
examples of what you just said. Exactly. Then it's up to you. Like I would never, you know, I was a different man by the time I changed. And then my sisters with my brother-in-law, but I would have never asked them for nothing. You know, I just like, I would have said, that's my sister and her life. I don't want to ruin it on them.
Right.
So there are guys that cross that line and say, I don't care what it is. I need the information or I need something. I got to find it out. And then you had, those dirty cops. It's a great, they come up in my volume 3, Esposito and Caracalla, who were doing all that stuff for Gaspipe Castle. Right. You know, I mean, Gaspipe was paying them a few grand on a month on a retainer. He was giving them, they were doing hits even. Those were demented guys. Sure. Those guys were sick. You know, your average cop is going to go, you can't give me $5,000 to break that line and risk my wife, my family, my kids, my jail
your pension,
time.
Everything. Yeah, absolutely.
Everything down the drain. Not anymore. It's different when you were bribing prohibition agents in the late 20s or early 30s.
Right.
You know, you guys are making $200 a month and you're offering them $2,000 for the day.
Sure.
You know, it's a different story. J. Edgar Hoover was supposedly terrified that if he looked too deep into the mob had deep pockets and they'd start bribing his agents and his agents might succumb to that. These guys are making $5,000 a year annual salary and Frank Costello's got that in his back pocket. You know, so like when, you know, that was one aspect I discussed briefly towards the end of Borgata,
right,
the first volume, when I talk about why Hoover looked the other way. But it goes the same thing with the NYPD. You could bribe cops many, many years ago, but now their jobs are too secure. They're too smart. They don't need it.
You'd be surprised, Lou. Like I would have never have guessed it when I was on patrol. Never would have guessed it. Never wouldn't have believed it. And then when I went to organized crime and then we start going up on wiretaps every now and then, and I say this in my books, every time we went up on a wire, one or two cops would wander onto that playing field. And be providing information. Yeah. I mean, we had a case, we had Asians shipping cars out of the country and we had two Bronx cops running plates for the thieves. So you really don't know. And sometimes, and these guys, those particular cops, it really wasn't about money. They were hanging out with the thieves and they were into motorcycles and cars. And when they would wreck a car, the thieves would get them parts for their bikes if they blew an engine or something. So it was more about a camaraderie, like you were saying earlier. It wasn't really about the money. It was about the camaraderie.
Didn't that guy, you guys would remember him. What was it? Michael Dowd?
Yeah.
He was
doing
it for the Rush, right? Out of the 7-5 or something. Or the
He just got out. He's doing podcasts and things now. He got caught up with a whole gang of guys that basically were ripping off drug dealers and then providing, they got involved in a drug war where they were with one faction. And so,
That was the Rush, right? More than the money. I think he was like a loose cannon, right? He was just like a hyper guy. And
opinion, I think you're right. I don't think it was really about the money with him. I think it was the Rush, the excitement.
Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah. So going back to Sicily. Yeah. They're very inclusive. They didn't want outsiders, et cetera. And I saw somewhere in your book that they married their cousins so they could like keep it all in the family.
Well, that's interesting. I don't want the whole island of Sicily getting mad at me right now. But supposedly, right? And my grandmother's rest her soul. She'd go ape shit on me right now if she heard this. But I was away with a Sicilian who said he married his cousin, or I found out he married his cousin, and I thought maybe second or third cousin.
Right.
I found out when I went on a visit, they looked identical to each other. You know, you could take off her wig and put it on his head. Like, you know, so I was like, whoa, they were first cousins. So I talked to other Sicilians that I knew and I realized that I'm Sicilian. I'm obviously Italian-American, Sicilian-American. So we grew up in an American culture where it's taboo to marry your cousin. Yes. But I learned that a lot of the Sicilians I knew married second, third cousins, some even first. So it wasn't sort of – and the reason being was I gathered from all my research is the marriage pools in these towns and villages you know, it wasn't like, oh, I go to Manhattan and meet a girl. I'm going to go dancing Friday night. And then I'm going to go to church maybe Sunday, meet a girl, maybe at the church, or maybe I'm going to go to, I'm going to go on online at my, on three, I'm on three dating sites. I'm meeting three different girls for tonight. Yeah. You don't have all that. You got a little shit town. Everybody knows each other. And there was power in the patriarchy. One patriarch would control a family clan. They did a lot of intermarrying. And if you go back in time, you know, the Rothschilds kept it in the family. Didn't they marry cousins and stuff, the Rothschilds? You know, and they were the biggest banking family in history. Mm. So you had mafia families a lot of times doing it too. The Gambinos. Carlo Gambino was, Paul Castellano was his nephew and his cousin. And then, yeah, so they were all interconnected, the Gambinos. Okay. There was like, all right. At one point, we're going to see in my volume two, I go into the Kennedy assassination, volume two of the Borgata trilogy. I go deep into the Kennedy assassination. Yeah. I urge everybody to read volume one of the Borgata trilogy so you can get to volume two. And volume two, I go deep into how Bobby Kennedy unraveled all of these sort of like incestuous relationships within the Gambino family clan. And he was so pissed off about it that he contacted the archdiocese and said, you guys got to crack down on these people and stop marrying them off. They're marrying each other. So, you know, and the archdiocese says, what do we do? You know, what do you want us to do? They donate too. And, you know,
okay. The feast.
So, yeah. Yeah. It was interesting. So, you know, you had a lot of that, much less of it today. You know, Sicilians are part of the global community today. You know, they're part of the world. But back then, a lot of different little towns and villages, the marriage pool was a lot, you know, was more so a puddle than a pool.
Yeah, it was shallow. And, okay.
Yeah. So, you know, they married each other and they married each other for strength. You keep it in the family. You keep right. the inheritance in the family. You keep the clout in the family, you know, and they married. Joe Profaci was the original boss of what became the Colombo family. He was the founder of what became the Colombo family when Joe Colombo took over. Profaci was the founder of that Borgata. Joe Profaci, two of his daughters married bosses in the Detroit mafia, and Bill Bonanno married Joe Profaci. I'm sorry, one daughter married the boss of the Detroit mafia. Another daughter, or niece rather, married Bill Bonanno, who was the heir to the Bonanno family. Then Carlo Gambino's son married Tommy Lucchese's daughter, Frances Lucchese. And so, you know, had all these guys intermarrying. These are like dynastic marriages, you know, throughout time, where the king marries, you know, the king of the Spanish throne marries his daughter off to the king of the queen of the English throne. And, you know, so they went back and forth with these things, even in the mob, they're intermarrying up until my time. So, gotcha. You know, it happens, but I don't think it happens as much today.
Right, right. So Sicilian immigrants, you know, turn of the century, they weren't exactly welcomed in the United States with open arms. Lots of racial slurs, working subpar jobs, and they pretty much only had themselves for comfort, and that made them stronger. You know, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, when Sicilians, my mother and father told me that they were discriminated against when they were young, so they remembered. My grandmother, who was Sicilian, was called an N. And my mother was the N-word, and because she was very dark. My grandmother, who was Sicilian, she was probably several shades darker than like a Will Smith. So, you know, she would go to pick my mother up from school, and they would go, you know, there's an N here to pick you up. You know, this is only, I'm going back. My mother was born in 1943 while my grandfather was fighting in the Pacific, in the Asiatic Pacific. So it's not that long ago, right? So she's a kid in the 50s going to school. So the Sicilians, the more I researched, the more the Sicilian Americans and Italian Americans at large were discriminated against, called the most horrific names. We all know Guinea Greaseball. I say it lightly now, but Guinea Greaseball, WAP, but also pizza ends turned inside out. Those discriminatory names they were called, and they were discriminated against on top of that. And they were the second biggest group to be lynched in the Deep South, which I never knew.
I didn't know that until I read your book.
Yeah, nobody knows. It's amazing. I don't know why we're silent on this, and shame on the academic community for not talking about it, because the academic community should teach us about the institution of slavery and how blacks were lynched. I think that's one of the greatest lessons that should be taught when you're young, because you should know about that. But you should also know that the second biggest group were the Italians. We were lynched next. So you know what? We weren't slaves. I'm not trying to – nobody could compare – the suffering of the African Americans. I want to be ultra clear. But if there was a next in line, it was the Italian Americans. You know, and look, the Irish went through a lot of crap when they came here. Irish went through a ton of shit. And the Irish now left the oppression that they experienced in Ireland to come here and experience a new wave of it here.
Yeah.
So, you know, by the English and the Germans who were here before the Irish. So everybody gets it. Like, you know, it's like the freshman gets beat up, right? And then becomes a sophomore and gives it to the next clan, you know, the next wave. So that's what happens. That's sort of like the immigrant waves into the United States. But I was surprised to learn the Italians were the second biggest group lynched in the South. And the biggest mass lynching in U.S. history was of Italians. So that blew my mind.
Was that in that prison? I'm trying to remember that from the book.
They stormed
a prison and they just started killing Sicilians.
Yeah. And the reason being, I urge people to read about it because it's a direct correlate. It's a direct connection to the mafia. Otherwise it couldn't have made it into my book, obviously. But what happened was the mob was strong in Louisiana.
I didn't know that either.
Yeah. They were really powerful in Louisiana. And the reason being, I didn't know. You know, I grew up in New York. My grandparents got right off the boat and ended up in New York. That's where I came from. And, you know, all my cousins grew up in New York. You always thought that all the Italians just got off the boat, Ellis Island, landed in New York. But a lot of them, you come from the Mediterranean and you end up in New York where there's 9 feet of snow. And you look around and you go, where can I go where I know the temperature? You know, they're not ready. They're not ready for it. They don't have the stamina. You know, you're not talking about Germans who grew up maybe in snow, you know, in the snowy north of Germany.
You're talking about
Scandinavians or whatever. You're talking about people from the Mediterranean. So they saw Louisiana as two things. One is they understood the climate to be close to what they understood in the Mediterranean. And the next thing, that was where work was. So they followed wherever the work was. Mm. Now, we had just dissolved the institution of slavery. So all of that slave labor was gone, and the southern plantations needed somebody to replace the slave labor. And they had these, you know, they needed cheap labor. And this wave of southern Italian immigrants were the perfect people to replace the slaves. You know, we could pay them close to slave labor, and just get them for nothing. And the Italian Americans who came here didn't care. They just wanted work. So they went there and they said, fine, use me, but at least I have a job and I could feed my family and then give them a better way of life. So that's how they sort of ended up in Louisiana. And then the mafiosos ride in on the wave and start to mobilize the waterfront as the Italian workers dominate the waterfront. They start to mobilize the French market, which was sold fruits and vegetables as the Italians dominated the French market and it became a Sicilian market and so on and so forth. So once the Italians are beefing in New Orleans, I urge people to read this because it's fascinating. They're beefing in New Orleans. The cop gets involved, the chief of the police.
Yeah.
Who, by the way, got his job there by killing the last chief of police, which was interesting. because that was the road up, you know, no matter where you were or who you were and back then. So they clip the cop, the mob does. And I think that what happened was, my belief is the mob was responsible for killing the cop, but there were a lot of people on the indictment who were innocent Italians, just hardworking Italians who got lumped into the indictment
for
the wrong reasons. And it ends up that the jury saw that and the jury acquitted them. No Italians on the jury and no African-Americans, by the way, who were very sympathetic towards the Italians because the Italians liked the African-Americans. They worked alongside them. They lived in the same ghettos with them. They voted for anything that helped them. So they got along. There were no blacks on the jury and no Italians on the jury. So you can't say it was fixed. You know, I mean, these people, unanimous jury acquits them. And the judge says, well, send them back to the jail. And then everybody calls for justice. The area said, you can't kill a cop. If you're going to walk out of the jury, then we're going to take justice into our own hands. They march on the prison and they blow their brains out. They hang them. They kill them.
Yeah.
And it's the biggest mass lynching in U.S. history. And who they let go? They let the real mobsters go. Tells you who's behind everything, right? The only real mobsters who were probably guilty stepped around the dead bodies and went home. But all the hardworking schleps got killed that day.
Yeah.
So I urge any of your listeners to read the book. It's very interesting. And you know, it's a piece of history not everyone knows. And I used good sources. Go to my notes in the back if you want to read more about it. I have a great bibliography. You could then
you do.
Next book, and continue on. If you want
to know more about it. One more thing that popped out to me from reading this book is, okay, Prohibition. We all know that, you know, the mafia profited off of Prohibition, millions of dollars, and so did the Kennedys. Yeah, the Kennedys made millions bootlegging. Now, were they in bed with the mafia at that time?
Yes. So there's a lot of evidence. That's part two, volume two of the Borgata trilogy. Cool. But I do talk about it. There was a lot of evidence to say to suggest that, first of all, there was testimony from Maya Lansky and Frank Costello that they dealt with Joe Kennedy. And then there's a lot of evidence that points to it as well. So Joe Kennedy had these, he had the connections to the distilleries where he could get the best stuff. He also had something to do with medical prescriptions. He had something to do with that as well. So supposedly he paid a lot of money to the bootlegging industry. And that's where he established these mafia contacts. So when John F. Kennedy, his son, was running for president, Joe Kennedy, using Frank Sinatra as a liaison between the mob and the Kennedy clan, was able to sort of get the Chicago mafia to swing a lot of the wards that they had control of towards Kennedy. You know, they kind of eked it out in Chicago.
Yeah.
There were different wards in Chicago that, you know, Nixon lost. It was something like 50 or 60 million people voted, and Nixon only lost by like 100,000 votes. And it was basically pulled off in Texas and in Chicago were the main places. And in Chicago, all the wards that were controlled by Sam Giancana and the mob were the ones that swung it towards the Kennedy. And then Mayor Daley, who was also considered crooked back then, Mayor Daley had something do with it. And then there was a lot of sort of investigation into election fraud at that time. And then that was supposedly why Joe Kennedy wanted John Kennedy, the new president, to appoint Robert Kennedy, one of his brothers, as attorney general to head off any investigations into election fraud. And that's basically the big component. I get into that heavily in volume two. Cool. It's extremely interesting. I think that the boys, meaning John and Bobby, I do believe that they were in the dark as to how much the father did to swing that election towards the son, because there was a lot of campaign money fueled into the West Virginia primary, which Kennedy almost thought he would lose when he pulled it out. He was competing against Humphrey at the time. And John Kennedy, during the West Virginia primary, thought he would lose to Humphrey in West Virginia because they didn't want a Catholic Irish president there. They were very WASPy. And they said, we're Protestants. We don't want a Catholic. It turned out not to be the case when the votes came out. They were definitely more open-minded than they anticipated. But he desperately was in need of cash for the West Virginia primary. And there's a lot of evidence to suggest that they funneled cash to the Kennedy campaign, through Frank Sinatra, through Joe Kennedy.
Okay.
During that, besides helping with the votes in Chicago and Texas, possibly. So that said, I do believe wholeheartedly that the boys were somewhat in the dark because Joe Kennedy was secretive. You know, he didn't tell the left hand what the right was doing, and he had no need to include his sons in those type of shenanigans that he was doing under the table. But I do think that there was a debt to be paid back to the mob. And what happened was, shortly after John became president, he was incapacitated. Joe Kennedy was.
Okay.
Joe Kennedy became a paraplegic. He had a massive stroke after a golf game. And I don't think he was able to then pay back the mob or express to his sons, we owe these guys. And then Bobby became a real SOB towards the mob.
Yes,
and the mob got fed up, and that's what happened. Yeah. And then we could, that's for podcast number two, if you want to come back.
That sounds good to me. So the mob also profited off the stock market crash in 1929.
They did. Well, the mob, now Joe Kennedy profited tremendously off the stock market crash. He sold short on like just about everything and became a multimillionaire during that crash. And everybody agrees that the things Joe Kennedy did during on Wall Street now would have landed him in jail for a million years. But they didn't have the tight oversight they have now. So pretty much what he was doing was just unethical, but it wasn't illegal in a lot of ways. But that said, during the crash, how the mob came out of that big was not only like connections with that, but they got blindsided too by it. But they come out of the crash, everybody, banks go under, and the few remaining banks are extremely tight with their credit. So the businesses across the country who can't go to banks for loans, they got to go somewhere. Well, the mob is just coming out of prohibition.
So they got all kinds of cash.
Yeah, they're flush with cash.
Yeah.
So if you go to the mob, let's say, you know, you and Vic can't go to a bank because you want to open up a good big podcast and you want to be national and stuff. You go to the mob, you go to Uncle Vinny and you say, hey, Uncle Vin, I need $100,000 for electrical equipment. I need to buy microphones. I need to buy a disc. I'm going to transmit it, whatever. And he gives you a piece, but he goes, look, I want 10% of the business.
Sure.
You know, so instead of, you know, instead of getting shaken down by a bank for the next 30 years, you just got to answer Uncle Vin. And now that's how they sort of got back, got into industries time and again, that they and ended up ensconced in for the next 5 or 6 decades, which is incredible. You know, so many went to them and they were flush with cash.
Then also World War II, they made money off of that, you know, black market and a few more things too. And the government actually asked the mob for help in New York City along the, like the docks and such as that. They didn't want U-boats in fucking New York Harbor.
World War II breaks out. And I have my grandfather, my mother's father, fought in the Asiatic Pacific. And my father was 7 years older than my mother. So his older brothers were old enough to fight. And they fought the Nazis in Europe, my father's two oldest brothers. My Uncle Joe was literally just finishing fighting the Nazis in Europe, getting on a boat to come home, the same boat that dropped off my Uncle Charlie. So they literally saw each other passing. Oh, by the grace of God, both made it home from the war. So when the Nazis are fighting, and my uncles now, don't forget, my uncles are the offspring of two immigrants that got off a boat in 1918. So they're Italians, my uncles.
Right.
They speak Italian at home, but they hated Mussolini. They became Italians. I got to tip my hat to Italians, like the Irish. They came in here, and within one generation, they were proud, patriotic Americans.
Absolutely.
It's incredible. And fought for their country. The Irish have been doing it since the Civil War, actually. Yep. So, you know, I mean, so this is like an incredible story how, you know, today I get sick when people get off, you know, they come here and they hate the country within 5 minutes. Where the old immigrant waves used to come here and love the country in 5 minutes.
Yep.
So it's a little bit different. But anyway, the Italians who were in America, including the mobsters, hated Mussolini, hated fascism, and hated the Nazis. So they were all willing to fight. Albert Anastasia put on a uniform and fought. Matty the Horse Iannello, who was still around when I was a kid, he was a tail gunner or something on you know, and had 30 runs or something over Nazi Germany, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, these guys were patriotic Americans. They fought, you know, for their country. They weren't afraid. My grandfather took numbers in a bar. My grandfather, who I told you, he gave birth to my uncle, who was a hijacker. My grandfather drove heavy machinery. He was an operating engineer, drove bulldozers and backhoes, excavators during the day. At night, he hung out in the bar and took numbers. Nobody would know he had 8 bronze stars in the Asiatic Pacific. He fought for his country, loved his country. But, you know, he still went home from the war and took numbers at night. You know, so, you know, that's different. So whatever the case is, the mobsters were proud Americans. So the naval intelligence, when they realized that the Nazis got Nazi subs off the coast of Long Island, or right off, you know, they're patrolling up and down the eastern seaboard, the naval intelligence gets nervous. So then there's a burning of a ship in the port of New York, and it's the USS Normandy. Rechristened the USS Lafayette after the Revolutionary War hero from France who helped us fight, who helped Washington fight, became close friends with Washington. The USS Lafayette was a French ocean liner that we renamed, and that burns in the port of New York. And we thought that there might have been sabotage connected to the burning of the Lafayette / Normandy. So it turns out that a naval investigation clears it of any sabotage, but the Navy is concerned enough. And they say, we need to secure the eastern seaboard, specifically the port of New York, because we're sending tons of troops and ammunition every day to Europe. And if we have to worry about U-boats and all kinds of sabotage on the waterfront, we're in trouble. So they reach out to the mobsters who control the waterfront, and they say, will you help us? And basically the answer was a resounding yes. We'll do anything we can to help you with the war. Now, don't forget, obviously, now, the feds look the other way while we steal power.
Yeah, they're making something out of that. Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, you know, the mob is the mob. They're not going to, like, you know, not jump on an opportunity. They're very opportunistic. So they're obviously stealing everything they can from the ports. In the meantime, they probably stole everything but a Sherman tank. Yeah. But short of that, they made sure that the eastern seaboard was secure, and they made sure that the troops would get, you know, and how they did it is interesting. So they control all the longshoremen, and all of the sea captains come in and report to the mob bosses on the waterfront. So they have like this roving lighthouse that everything they spot at sea, they're telling the mobsters, who then report it to naval intelligence. So, you know, it's like a chain of command. And this one particular guy who was a capo in Luciano's family has direct a direct pass to go visit a lieutenant colonel on a weekly basis to inform of what's going on the waterfront. So they're in constant contact. So the mob really does a tremendous job in helping to secure the waterfront during the war. And then they tried to bury that, the U.S. Navy, later on after the war. They didn't want to let the public know that the Navy really, you know, was in bed with the mob. And then it came out in a strange way where Thomas Dewey was accused. Governor Dewey, who originally prosecuted mobsters, was he was accused of being in bed with the mob. And then he ordered a big, massive investigation of what the mob did to help the Navy during World War II. And then the Navy asked him to bury that report. And it surfaced after he died, after Dewey died. And that's how we came to know how much the mob has done for the United States on the Eastern Seaboard during the war.
Interesting. So what should we expect in book two of the trilogy?
Book two starts off where book one ends, which is book one goes from the 1860s to 1960, 1860s Sicily to 1960 America. Book two picks up with Kennedy inaugurated, takes over, mob helps him get in. And we start off with Kennedy and the CIA mafia plot to kill Castro, because I talk about how the mob took over Cuba in book one. So book two now, they're trying to kill Castro so they could get back Cuba. They're in bed with the CIA trying to do it. And then we go on to the Gallo revolt against Joe Profaci, the Gallo Wars. We go to the Banana Wars. We go to eventually we end up going to John Gotti and his sort of like he's on the rise at the end of volume two, and he confronts Castellano, Paul Castellano. So we bring it up to 1985. So volume two goes from 1960 to 1985 and everything that happens between there. And it's really, really interesting, even to me as a writer, just the events itself, not to toot my own horn as a writer, but I mean, the events itself, even without my input, are extremely interesting.
Okay. Yeah. So how about fiction? When are you going to start writing fiction?
You know, the only thing I wrote was that novel. So hopefully it comes out, you know, eventually maybe I'll go to it. Now that you're telling me mob romance is a hot.
I can just
the old stories in my head. You know, I mean, my whole life was a mob romance on the street.
So who would you want? So say one of your fiction books gets made into like a series or a movie. Who would you want as your leading man or leading woman?
Oh, I have no idea. I don't know.
Okay.
I mean, it's hard. Yeah, I have no idea. I don't even know who's like hip now, young and, you know, I'm in bed with a book at 8, 9 o'clock at night.
I know. All right. Hey, I've got a Cops and Writers Facebook group. There's a couple of questions in there real quick. Ellis K. Popa asks, why is it so hard for people to get out of crime syndicates once they're entangled? I think we went through that. Let's see here. She also asks, are there really cleaners like in movies like Pulp Fiction?
Yes and no. I mean, they don't call them cleaners, but you got guys that I know guys who were on murder scenes, and they basically, you're supposed to take part in something like a murder when you get straightened out. You used to. The rules are different now. You don't have to. But you used to have to take part in a murder to get straightened out. And taking part didn't always mean shooting the guy or killing the guy or strangling the guy. Sometimes the guy who came in and mopped up the floors was part of the crew. So, you know, he cleaned up the mess afterwards. He put the body in the bag and he put it in somebody's trunk and he got his button because he participated in a murder. You know, would you call him a cleaner? Not in the same sense as Pulp Fiction, but he cleaned up a murder scene and he got his button.
You know, but there were also guys that you could bring a car to crush a car or to shred a car because the cops are going to be looking for it because it was involved in something to make it disappear.
Vic, I brought a million cars to people, not for murders, but for I do a heist and get rid of the car. So I bring it to a guy and say, look, take the parts. You know, he was happy he got all the parts, and I was happy that it gets gone.
Ellis has another question. I've already had so much family drama and hometown gossip with my little old YA suspense coming out. Has Mr. Ferrante experienced any crazy drama or incidents since he became an author with his former associates?
So I have no problems with them as of now. The guys I still see on the streets once in a while.
Yeah.
Hello and goodbye. They know I never ratted. There are a few guys who are hardliners and say, well, you're a rat if you even talk about it. Mm. Are you kidding me? You know, I mean, I never put anybody in jail. I never took the stand, never gave information above or below board, nothing. So, talking about it is talking about it. I'm talking about stuff that's 30 years old. So I never ratted. So I don't get any drama from people. The guys who really knew me, they still respect me. I bumped into guys. I was in Staten Island in November. I bumped into a lot of guys that I knew from back then. They were all happy to see me. They all gave me big hugs and kisses. I was happy to see them. They know I never ratted. I know they never ratted. That's the bottom line. Gotcha. I had one guy email me once. I changed the name in my memoir and gave a guy a different name who's now a captain in the Gambino family. And he emailed me and said, I hated the name you gave me.
Okay. All right.
That's it.
Miriam Hashim says, I don't have a question, but I do have gratitude. I read Mr. Franti's book on what the mob can teach businessmen a few years ago. It is a goldmine of a book. I reread it on a regular basis. I work as a geopolitical analyst, mostly focusing on terrorism, and I use concepts from the book all the time. I'm usually the only woman in my very misogynistic environment, so I have lots of fun applying Mr. Ferrante's concepts to change the power dynamics. Does he ever come to Ireland or the UK for book tours or festivals?
Wow. Thank you so much. I will say first, that was a beautiful compliment, and I'm glad it's been useful. I used to go to the UK much more often than I do now. I hope to go back there. If someone invites me, I get on the plane and go. I unfortunately, as many friends as I have who are from Ireland, and I met great guys in jail who are from Ireland, I have not been to Ireland. I hope to go. I love the Irish people. I love the Irish culture. So I hope to go there. But ask her if she could invite me, have a group invite me, bring me over.
Okay.
I'm there. So let's hope. Yep. And everybody, all your listeners could Facebook me. It's the Facebook with the red. You'll see a picture of Borgata. Okay. So feel free or go to my website, louisferrante.com, and drop me an email.
Sounds good. So let's start wrapping this up, man. This is, I could talk to both of you guys forever. This is so much fun. What advice would you give to a kid or adult who's pondering the gangster lifestyle?
Don't do it. The mistakes you make when you're young, you might think that they're easy mistakes. It's not the same as falling off a bike where you got a scab and it's better by the end of the week. Mistakes you make when you're young that are big last for many, many, many years, and they're very hard to undo. And a mistake like this took me many, many years to undo and a lot of suffering. So I would advise you the same thing. And a lot of people die in the interim. I have friends who died. I have friends who never leave jail. I'm very lucky that I'm here, but don't do it. Don't make a mistake that you'll regret for the rest of your life. Make stupid mistakes that you could fix by the end of the day. Don't make big mistakes that are going to last years or hurt other people or yourself.
Okay. Yeah. So the next question is for my deep thinkers. And I think you're a deep thinker, Lou. And somebody who's been through a lot of stuff. So if you had a billboard that millions could see, what would you put on it? Like a favorite quote or saying?
Trust in yourself, have faith in God, and you can never do wrong by doing what's right.
Perfect. I love it. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. So let's wrap this up. Where do people go to find out more about you and your books?
LouisFerrante.com, LouisFerrante.com is my website. Everything's there. You could find the books anywhere. They're in Amazon. They're in Barnes & Noble. But also you could via the website. There's also a thing there. You could feel free to email me. I try to get back to everybody. Sometimes it takes a little time if I'm busy, but I eventually do get around to answering all my emails. So feel free to get in touch, and I hope everyone buys the book. You could find it anywhere, any bookstore, anywhere books are sold. Once again, Borgata, the Borgata Trilogy, Volume 1 is out now. And also that lovely lady mentioned Mob Rules. Mob Rules was my international bestseller. It was translated into 20 languages. I was very fortunate that book had tremendous reach across the planet, and it continues to sell well. That's been probably the best thing I wrote until now. So hopefully this outdoes that at some point.
All right.
But I just hope that people enjoy the read, and I'm glad, I had an absolute, great time with you and Vic, Pat. You guys were great. Absolute pleasure to talk to you both. Extremely intelligent men, fun to talk with. That was great. Not since, Brett McKay, who you mentioned,
yeah,
was another brilliant guy. So I'm not surprised you listened to his podcast.
Now, Vic, do you have anything before we close out?
Yeah, sure. Just tell your listeners to go to my Amazon book page, type in my name, Vic, Ferrari Like the Car, where you can preview all my NYPD behind-the-scenes stories for free, $10 paperback, $2.99 ebook download, and my podcast, NYPD Laughing in the Line of Duty.
All right. Thank you, Vic, and thank you, Lou. This has been a whole lot of fun.
Same here. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, everyone, for listening to the conclusion of my interview with former Gambino crime family boss and now best-selling author Lou Ferrante. And a big thank you to my co-host for today, former NYPD detective, now podcaster and author, Vic Ferrari. This conversation was so enjoyable and informative and inspirational. The best of luck to you, Lou, and thank you, Vic, for your valuable insights. Well, that wraps up another episode of the Cops and Writers Podcast. If you haven't done so yet, you take a minute and rate and review the show on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. If you have already, thank you. As always, thank you for all of your support, and, of course, let's be careful out there.